This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, February 20, 2004. At WBAI New York, I'm Amma Insiabwadi. Haitians respond to their country's political crisis. Reverend Al Sharpton challenges fellow Democrats to address the killing of Timothy Stansbury Jr.
Police misconduct and racial profiling is as much a presidential campaign issue as ethanol is in Iowa.
And we look at race relations in Australia. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. 20 marriage licenses have been issued to same-sex couples in Sandoval County, New Mexico, just north of Albuquerque, according to a county clerk. After asking for an opinion from the county's attorney, County Court Clerk Victoria Dunlop said there is no legal reason to withhold them. State law in New Mexico defines marriage as a civil contract between parties without making mention of gender. Clerks in Santa Fe and Bernalillo counties cited a 1961 statute that created the marriage license form, which specifically asks for information from male and female applicants as reason to deny the same gendered couple's licenses to marry. The Sandoval County clerk said they would continue to issue marriage licenses until the state attorney says otherwise. And San Francisco city officials are suing the state of California on the ground that state laws banning same-sex marriage are unconstitutional. More from Kelly Ramirez at KPFA in Berkeley.
City Attorney Dennis Herrera filed the suit to make sure California's ban on same-sex marriage gets litigated. Until now, legal questions have centered on whether San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom has the power to interpret the state's equal protection clause on his own, change the wording of marriage licenses, and recognize same-sex marriage in his city. To date, the city has married over 3,000 same-sex couples. California Attorney General Bill Lockyer, who says he believes in domestic partnership and civil unions, has announced that he will defend Proposition 22, a voter initiative passed in 2000 to ban same-sex marriage. San Francisco is also defending against two suits brought by groups who are against same-sex marriage. The San Francisco suit names these groups as defendants. A hearing on whether the three suits should be consolidated into one case is scheduled for today. For FSRN, I'm Kelly Ramirez in Berkeley.
Iranian citizens refuse to cast their ballots today in pivotal elections. Mathis Kajarais has the story.
The Iranian government today held elections to determine the 7th Majlis parliament despite persistent protests by reformists unhappy with the disqualification of 2,500 of their party's candidates. However, a majority of Iran's 46 million citizens are refusing to cast their ballots, resulting in one of the lowest voter turnouts in years. Low turnout is attributed to widespread disenchantment with President Khatami's reformist party's failure to implement change in the country. As one citizen remarked, voting for any of the candidates is like selecting a stone statue as your representative. Polls in Iran were repeatedly extended in hopes of increasing turnout. This is Matthew Keshavarz in New York, reporting for Free Speech Radio.
Bush administration officials are ignoring dangerous toxic sites in the United States as the Superfund account dwindles, according to Environmental Protection Agency internal documents. Mitch Jeserich reports from D.C.
The Superfund is a reserve of money to pay for the cleanup of hazardous toxic sites around the country. It was funded by a special tax on corporations identified as polluters that expired in 1995. Since, the Superfund has declined by 35% as its primary funding now comes from general tax dollars. The official statement from the EPA is that there is no problem because companies are cleaning up their own mess. But internal EPA documents discovered by the EPA Inspector General shows that some officials worry that dangerous toxic sites are being ignored. Kevin Curtis is with the National Environmental Trust.
A lot of Superfund sites are in urban areas. The people still living around the urban areas are either poor or minority or both and don't have the resources to move or even sue.
Senators Barbara Boxer, a Democrat from California, and Jim Jeffords, an independent from Vermont, are pushing for the reauthorization of the Superfund tax on polluting corporations, but it will be a difficult feat as President George Bush opposes it. I'm Mitch Jeserich for Free Speech Radio News.
Russian officials say they are prepared to move ahead with their next generation of intercontinental missiles. Megan Britton has more from D.C.
The U.S. is defenseless against new Russian missile technology, tested this week according to Phil Coyle, senior advisor for the Center of Defense Information and former Assistant Secretary of Defense. A Russian military spokesperson announced that Russia has developed maneuvering reentry vehicles to avoid missile shield defenses, like the one the U.S. is developing. Russian President Vladimir Putin is signaling he is willing to pump billions of dollars into weapons development. U.S. officials say that the proposed defense system was never capable of protecting against Russia, which can launch multiple missiles at once. Instead, the Pentagon highlights the system's capability to defend against strikes from other countries. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Megan Britton.
The United States Supreme Court has agreed to hear from U.S. citizens who say the government cannot strip them of their rights. Lawyers for Jose Padilla and Yasser Issam Hamdi say the men are being held indefinitely without charge or access to proper legal counsel in violation of the U.S. Constitution. The Bush administration claims they are enemy combatants, a term with no legal precedent in either U.S. courts or international law. The U.S. Supreme Court will weigh the rights of these individuals with the power of the executive branch in April. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The Associated Press is reporting that diplomats from the U.S. and other countries have presented a plan for political reform and a return to the rule of law to Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. This follows a spate of anti-government attacks in Haiti that have left some 50 people dead. But many poor Haitians in the capital of Port-au-Prince say they still support President Jean-Bertrand Aristide despite the worsening political conflict and unabated poverty. Reed Lindsay reports from Port-au-Prince.
Every Wednesday, several hundred poor women wearing white dresses and blue headscarves gather outside this capital city's hulking white cathedral to pray for President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. They belt out hip-swaying songs with religious fervor, wave their hands in the air with rosary beads wrapped around their wrists, and plea for divine intervention in favor of their beloved president.
We need Haiti to be free. We didn't buy our president. We voted for our president. And it's us poor people that put him in power.
Aristide might just need the prayers of these women. Rebels who seized the port city of Gonaïves 2 weeks ago have announced plans to overthrow the government. Yesterday, they declared that they had established their own independent country. Meanwhile, opposition leaders in Port-au-Prince continue to call for Aristide's resignation, accusing him of corruption, arming pro-government gangs, and driving the economy into the ground. But Aristide is still revered in the sprawling slums of Port-au-Prince, where he crusaded on behalf of the poor as a Catholic priest under military rule in the 1980s. Now serving in his second term as president, Aristide continues to be seen as a hero fighting against a powerful and tiny elite and their international backers. Rhea Dole is a 38-year-old kindergarten teacher at a community-organized school for poor children.
We have a little power in our hands to keep our children to get an education, but the elite have everything and they want to control everything. With a good education, a poor person can become president like Aristide. His mother was poor and he became president.
Life has not gotten much easier for most Haitians under Aristide. He has been credited with opening hundreds of schools and disbanding Haiti's notoriously repressive military. But the nation's crushing poverty, a state in which 80% of Haitians find themselves, has worsened by many accounts. Antoine Théou sits on the cement porch of his one-story cinder block house in a slum called Delmas 32. He quit his job as a security guard at a factory last September, frustrated that he was spending nearly half his $2-a-day income getting to work by public transportation. He has not found a job since. His wife, Jula, complains of rising prices. Everything has gone up, she says, including rice, cooking oil, and the fish she fries and sells on the street. But the family does not blame Aristide.
If the opposition would just give him a chance, he would do some great things. I haven't gotten anything from him, but he's reached out to many others.
Aristide is an unlikely populist. Slender and short, he wears glasses and looks like he could be a bookish professor. But he possesses an almost mythic reputation among the majority of Haitians who are black and poor. He is loved by many as if he were a family member, and he is admired for leading daring verbal assaults on the brutal governments of the 1980s, and for having survived numerous assassination attempts. This support was not apparent yesterday in the rebel-controlled city of Gonaïves, however, where thousands marched in the streets, some drunk and armed, calling for Aristide's downfall. Armed pro-government militias based out of Port-au-Prince's slums warn they will defend Aristide should the rebels try a coup or attack the presidential palace. Relienne Richard says she will also be waiting for them. Petite and wide-eyed, Richard was one of hundreds of women raped by the FRAP paramilitary in the early 1990s. One of the leaders of the current rebellion, Louis Jodel Chamblan, was second in command with the FRAP.
We don't have arms, but we'll mobilize ourselves with a voter card in our hands to support the president. They have guns and they're coming to kill us, but we're going to mobilize together to show the international community that we all stand behind the president.
In Port-au-Prince, Haiti, I'm Reed Lindsay for Free Speech Radio News.
The recall referendum that Venezuela's opposition is trying to organize against President Hugo Chavez is running into problems. The Elections Commission that is verifying the signatures of the recall petition is calling into question a large proportion of the signatures, and both sides in the country's political conflict are saying that fraud is involved. Meanwhile, yesterday, the opposition announced that it would hold primaries to choose a presidential candidate should Chavez lose an eventual recall referendum. Greg Wilpert has this story from Caracas, Venezuela.
Venezuela's opposition announced yesterday that it will organize primary elections with a runoff vote to choose its presidential candidate should its recall of President Chavez succeed. Opposition leader Francisco Martinez.
Following a comprehensive consultation among civil society, social institutions, non-governmental organizations, unions, political parties, and the persons who are considered possible presidential candidates, all, without exception, have expressed their agreement to present a unity candidate, chosen via primary elections, which we are thus announcing to the country.
The opposition, which is desperate to remove President Chavez from office, says that Chavez is leading the country towards Castro communism. Following a failed coup attempt 2 years ago and a 2-month shutdown of the country's all-important oil industry, the opposition had organized a signature collection drive last November in order to petition for a recall referendum against the president. After numerous delays, the Elections Council, which is verifying the signatures, says it will have the results by the end of the month. Francisco Carrasquero, the Elections Council president, confirmed the date yesterday.
On February 29th of the current year, we will present the results of the verification process.
One reason for the delays has to do with the many irregularities the Election Council found with the signatures the opposition collected. Opposition leader Francisco Martinez.
It is clear that the government has put into action its decision to impede by any means a recall referendum, which would soundly defeat the president.
Government supporters say the opposition falsified many of the signatures. This week, President Chavez added another charge, saying that the main organization that has been involved in the logistics of collecting signatures against him, known as SUMATE, is being funded by the U.S. government.
SUMATE is part of a political sector, we know that, and it is supported by the government of the United States. I denounce this before the world, and we will also do so before the corresponding institutions. Citizens of North America, your money is being used, instead of for schools or something like that, it is being sent to organizations such as SUMATE.
The charge is based on the fact that SUMATE received a $54,000 grant from the National Endowment for Democracy, which, in turn, is funded by the U.S. Congress and which has a track record for funding opposition groups in countries whose governments are not in line with the prevailing U.S. government interests. SUMATE's executive director, Corina Machado, says that its actions are transparent and that the organization has nothing to hide.
It's not necessary for anyone to investigate us, looking for documents abroad. All of our documents are available for any institution or citizen that is interested in knowing something about SUMATE.
Venezuelans are now waiting, with increasing anxiety, as to whether there will be a recall referendum. If there is one, Chavez supporters said that they will accept it and are confident that he will win. However, they say that they will not accept a referendum that was achieved via falsified signatures. The opposition, however, insists that there are enough valid signatures for a recall. A clash between the two sides seems unavoidable once a decision is reached 10 days from now. Greg Wilpert reporting for Free Speech Radio News from Caracas, Venezuela.
In response to the failure of the grand jury to return with an indictment of New York City policeman Richard Neri, who was charged with wrongfully killing Brooklyn teenager Timothy Stansbury Jr., Democratic presidential candidate Reverend Al Sharpton yesterday challenged his fellow Democratic primary candidates to address the issue in their New York campaigns leading up to Super Tuesday on March 2nd. In Brooklyn, New York, Ian Forrest has this story.
Police misconduct and racial profiling is as much a presidential campaign issue as ethanol is in Iowa. How do we in good faith come to New York and Los Angeles, both cities that have had repeated incidents of police misconduct, and ignore this glaring problem?
Reverend Al Sharpton, Democratic presidential candidate, speaking at a press conference in downtown Brooklyn yesterday, called to address the failure of the grand jury established by Brooklyn District Attorney Charles Hines to investigate the shooting death of Timothy Stansbury by police officer Richard Neri. Reverend Sharpton was also critical of the Brooklyn District Attorney, establishing that he had a history of failing in cases of this nature to secure indictments.
This case is a case in point as to why we would not cooperate with Hines on Louima and went to the federal government. And Hines has shown here, in the most blatant of cases, that they will not prosecute police when it comes to questions of police misconduct.
At the press conference was New York City Council member Charles Barron, who reiterated his call for the establishment of residency requirements for the police officers who patrol the communities of the city. Barron added it was time for the federal government to step in.
You could be next. Who is going to be next, and what do we do next? When we don't get justice from the DA's office, now is time for the federal government to come and do the right thing and have justice for this family who is suffering and will be suffering for the rest of their lives while this officer goes home to his family and has a dinner.
Reports are that in the early hours of morning on January 24, Stansbury Jr. and some friends made their way between the buildings of their Bedford-Stuyvesant housing project. Officer Neri and his partner were on patrol in the housing complex. As both groups approached the door to the roof from different sides, the door opened. Neri fired a single shot from his already drawn gun and killed the African-American teen. Neri passionately delivered a tearful testimony to the grand jury. His tears, which may have helped to convince jurors of no wrongdoing on his part, failed to move Timothy Stansbury Sr., father of the slain youth. The elder Stansbury contends that the officer failed to follow proper procedures and should suffer the consequences for doing so.
I never heard it mentioned that he ever told my son to stop or halt or freeze. He never pronounces those words out. His gun shot before his mouth shot. A trained police officer didn't follow the right procedures.
The failure of the grand jury to indict Neri has members of the African community in New York seriously concerned. Marcel Owens, a Brooklyn mother of two, faces the tough challenge of explaining to her children how a police officer could walk free after shooting and killing an unarmed youth.
It's very difficult. You walk in the streets and somebody could just... A cop could just kill you for no reason. There's nothing I can say. I don't know what to say.
Attorney for the Stansbury family, Kenneth Mansour, says the matter is now in the hands of U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of New York, Rosalyn Moskorf, who will investigate the findings of the Brooklyn grand jury to determine whether the civil rights of Timothy Stansbury Jr. were violated. Meanwhile, New Yorkers from at least a dozen organizations standing in solidarity with the Stansbury family turned out in the streets of Manhattan today, calling for justice. For FSRN in New York, I am Ian Forrest.
This week marks 8 years since the signing of the San Andre Accords between the Zapatista Army and the Mexican federal government. Although the San Andre Accords permit autonomous and traditional forms of government in Mexico's indigenous communities, recent and ongoing violations of the right to self-government prompted a meeting of hundreds of members of indigenous groups to discuss the current situation of political and cultural autonomy in Mexico. Shannon Young and Vladimir Flores filed this report.
As Zapatista supporters in the Montes Azules region see their houses burned and residents of Tlalnepantla, Morelos continue to be displaced by a police occupation of their town, representatives of indigenous communities from Oaxaca, Michoacán, Morelos, and Central Mexico met to demand respect for the right to self-governance. Member of Tlalnepantla's Autonomous Council in Exile, Ben Joseph Laguna, explains the importance of fighting for self-governance as indigenous people.
El gobierno federal, a través de la Secretaría de Gobernación,
the federal government, by the way of the Secretary of Government, has said that they will not permit new forms of government. And we told them that the indigenous peoples form a government. That ways in which decisions are made collectively had been established before political constitutions of 1857 and 1917 even appear. Besides, we are within our right given to us by history to demand respect for the autonomy of our community and those of our brother and sister communities to make their own decisions how to live.
Eight years ago this week, the Zapatistas signed the San Andrés Accords with the federal government. The accords include recognition of the rights of indigenous people to autonomy, bilingual education, and collective use of natural resources. While the federal government insists that indigenous rights are respected, in 2001 the legislature declined to guarantee those rights in the constitution. Salvador, from the Purépecha region of Michoacán, explains the consequences of not including indigenous self-determination as a constitutional amendment.
Fuimos nuevamente ante el poder judicial y también nos negaron.
We went before the judicial branch again, and they also denied us what we are demanding. For this reason, in the Purépecha lands, we've decided that our constitution is the San Andrés Accords. We don't recognize other laws. We don't recognize another constitution. For the Indian people of Michoacán's Purépecha region, the constitution is the San Andrés Accords.
Los acuerdos de San Andrés.
The armed Zapatista uprising on January 1, 1994, coincided with the implementation of the North American Free Trade Agreement. One of the political factors that led to this rebellion was the overturning of Emiliano Zapata's contribution to the Mexican Constitution, Article 27, which explicitly protected communal ownership of farmland. Member of the farmers' collective Unión de Comuneros Emiliano Zapata de Michoacán, Eva Cortés, explains that communal land ownership is an integral part of indigenous resistance to cultural imperialism.
Las comunidades indígenas.
We indigenous communities are the base upon which the foreigners impose their so-called nation. The communal lands of this country of Mexico have been ours since time immemorial, and are and will continue to be of the Indians. Those who disrespect us call us Indians, but we take this disrespect and turn it into pride.
Meanwhile, the situation in Tlalnepantla continues. The root of the crisis lies in the conflict over the popularly recognized traditional form of government and the rule of a political machine backed by little force. Although the state government continues to sidestep negotiations, the displaced townspeople and exiled Autonomous Council of Tlalnepantla will continue to demand their rights to self-determination by marching in the state capital of Cuernavaca on Monday and organizing with other indigenous municipalities.
¡Viva la comunidad indígena de Tlalnepantla, Morelos!
In Malacaxtepec, Momoxco, Vladimir Flores with Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Gracias, compañeras y compañeros.
This week, Australia was rocked by riots that took place in Sydney's notorious Redfern district after the death of a 17-year-old Aboriginal teen, Thomas Hickey, in a bike accident. Several eyewitnesses reported that Hickey was being chased by police moments before, leading many to blame them for his death. The incident is being viewed against the backdrop of race relations in Australia, a country where many Indigenous people remain severely disadvantaged with no formal treaty processes in place. Erica Voles has this report.
What's going on in Redfern is far greater than just a clash between police and Indigenous people.
Phil Glendenning, National President of Australians for Native Title and Reconciliation.
We make a fundamental mistake if we run off to solution jump about the relationship between police and Indigenous people. What we've got to deal with in this country is the unfinished business of our history.
The sentiment behind Glendenning's statement is shared by many advocating equality for Indigenous people. While some in the white community have dismissed the riots as senseless acts of violence, those living and working in the area, such as Aboriginal pastor Bill Simon, say the rage must be placed in a wider context of fear of the police.
I think your listeners should know that the majority of our community, our Aboriginal communities, where they live all around Australia, there are places there where the police are always, and I mean this always, chasing Aboriginal kids. We grow up like that. And if you're black, that's it. You know, you've got a stamp on you. And the police are going to target you whether you do things or not.
The police have denied the practice of racial targeting. Darren Bennett, the crime manager at Redfern Police Station, claims that the only children that have something to fear from the police are those that are involved in criminal activity.
Well, I think people with the most to be afraid from the police are people who commit offences. I don't really agree with the assertion that people in general are afraid of the police, and that's not my experience in policing in Redfern or anywhere else I've been involved in the police service. There's just no level of targeting of anyone based on race in the police service.
In a move that highlights the sensitive nature of current race relations in Australia, three separate inquiries have been launched into the situation. The coroner will examine the circumstances leading up to Hickey's death, the police will conduct their own investigation into circumstances surrounding the riot, and the ombudsman will oversee them both. However, the Aboriginal community says they feel no justice will come out of these reports unless Indigenous people are involved. Speaking at a protest in Canberra on the issue, Indigenous consultant and activist Kerry Reid-Gilbert conveys the level of distrust felt within the Indigenous community.
Any Aboriginal person in Australia today can write the findings of these independent inquiries for the government. They can write it. Accidental death. You know, things like this. We weren't involved. We can write it down right now. They don't need to pay millions of dollars. But at least we have Aboriginal consultants in there that we know that the truth will be told.
Phil Glendenning says that the uprisings can only be tackled if the hard realities of life for Aboriginals are finally addressed by white Australia.
Aboriginal children die 20 years younger than everyone else. The incarceration rates are 19 times higher than the rest of the population. Now, these sorts of indicators tell us that we've got a crisis here. A crisis that's not dissimilar that we see in countries like Sierra Leone and Mozambique, which have had serious civil wars going on over a number of years. The statistics are the same. So the priority basically is not to do less, it's to adequately resource that issue by enabling Aboriginal people to identify what their concerns are, identify what their needs are, enable people to be trained and skilled and have access into the community so that healthy people can live healthy lives.
The events of Redfern have brought into sharp relief the mistrust that exists on both sides of the community. And with no deadline set for when the findings of the three investigations are to be handed down, it remains to be seen how long it will take for all the talk about wider reconciliation between black and white Australia to translate into action. This is Erica Voles reporting in Sydney for Free Speech Radio News.
You are listening to Free Speech Radio News. Free Speech Radio News was produced at Pacifica stations KPFA, KPFK, WBAI and community radio station WMNF. For more information or to visit our news archive, visit the website www.fsrn.org. I'm Amma Insia Bwadi.